Hi, so today we'll be reading from Mark 13, from 1 to 37. So, verse 1. As he was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." "Do you see all these great buildings?" replied Jesus. "Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled?" Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and he will deceive many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pains. You must be on your guard. You will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Whenever you are arrested and brought to trial, do not worry beforehand about what to say. Just say whatever is given to you at the time, for it is not you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down or enter the house to take anything out. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that this will not take place in winter, because those will be days of distress unequaled from the beginning when God created the world until now and never to be equaled again. If the Lord had not cut short these days, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, whom he has chosen, he has shortened them. At that time, if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is Christ,' or 'Look, there he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform signs and miracles to deceive the elect, if that were possible. So be on your guard. I have told you everything ahead of time. But in those days, following that distress, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, men will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And he will send his angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heavens. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about the day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, be alert. You do not know when that time will come. It's like a man going away. He leaves his house and puts his servants in charge, each with his assigned task, and tells the one at the door to keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know when the owner of the house will come back, whether in the evening or at midnight, or when the rooster crows or at dawn. If he comes suddenly, do not let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch."
When it comes to the end of the world, most of us, I think, fall into one of two camps. We're either skeptics or alarmists. Now, the alarmists come in all sorts of shapes and forms. Some of them are the preppers, you know, those people who've built the air raid shelter, the nuclear bunker under their house. They've stacked it with Band-Aids, with tins of Spam and baked beans. They're ready for anything. Others are more Christian. That is, we're expecting the end of the world with the return of Jesus, and we're looking for the signs of it. Maybe it was the year 2000 with the Y2K bug, which none of you remember, but my computer was very afraid of. Well, earthquakes happen, another tsunami. 250,000 people killed in 2004. Massive earthquakes still happening around the world. And we wonder, is this it? Is this the end? But for others, we're sceptical. There's an article in the latest Pelican magazine, your own Guild magazine, Apocalypse Now, where somebody, I don't know if there's a student here at UWA, has written about this end of the world scenarios and people who worry about it. But he basically comes to the conclusion that the end of the world and people being scared of it is really just us projecting our death, our mortality, onto the universe and thinking that we're more important than we really are. He's a sceptic, I think. And I suspect most people around university, including many Christians, are underneath pretty sceptical about any of the end of the world scenarios. Yeah, I guess things like global warming have made people stop and think. I wonder what the future of the world will be, but you know, when you're having those discussions about global warming and what will the world be like in 100 years' time, I suspect that they're not wanting you to say, well, actually, I believe Jesus is going to come back one day and finish this world. World history will get wound up and something different will come. That's just not on people's minds and hearts, is it? And I suspect even for many of us, if we're Christians, it's not on our minds and our hearts. It's hard to believe that the world will end that sort of way. Normally it doesn't even cross our mind that tomorrow, the day after, next week, Jesus may return. And the world as we know it will finish, will come to a grinding halt, and Jesus will judge everyone. I remember as a younger Christian coming across a verse in Matthew 24, it is, where Jesus says, "I will come when no one is expecting me." I can't tell you the turmoil that caused me, because what it meant was, at least as I understood it as a 15-year-old, I think it was Jesus says, I'll come when no one is expecting me. So if I'm not expecting him and he comes, I'm in trouble, because I'm not ready for him. But if I am expecting him, he can't come. So I got all sorts of knots, got myself wound up. It could never work out one way or another. Whatever way it happened, I was going to be a loser. It wouldn't work out well. Well, chapter 13 of Mark is a favourite for the alarmists, for those who see some apocalyptic ending, some prophetic foretold ending to the world. And rightly so, it ought to get us on the edge of our seat at one level. The catalyst in Mark chapter 13 is a question that comes. Well, not a question, actually, an observation to start with, and then some questions. In verse 1, as they leave the temple courts, one of his disciples says, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." And the temple that they were talking about really was a magnificent building. It was a building, it was the third temple that had. Solomon built the first one in about 1000 BC, and it was a wonder. It was destroyed, though, by the Babylonians in 587. Later on, in about 480, under Zerubbabel, they rebuilt a temple, but it was a pretty hopeless one. The Romans destroyed it in 63 BC. But then King Herod the Great, in 19 BC, set out on this project to build the greatest temple that you can imagine. He cleared the whole of Temple Mount and levelled it into a huge platform, 500 metres by 300 metres. It was gigantic, and on it he built one of the most impressive buildings of the ancient world. You think of the Colosseum and some of the other buildings of the Roman Empire. This one rivaled that in many of its ways. Some of the biggest blocks in its foundations were 12 metres by 6 metres by 4 metres, weighing over 600 tonnes. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. People describe coming over the hill and seeing Jerusalem in front of them for the first time and being dazzled by the whiteness of the marble and the brilliance of the gold that they could see in the temple. And that's what the disciple says. See these magnificent buildings. They're just fantastic, aren't they, Jesus? You can see the sort of scope of the temple court in that picture. Or here is a modern picture of one of the blocks left over in the foundations of that temple. There was great pride in it, but it wasn't just an impressive building. For every Jew, it was a very significant building because the God who lived everywhere, who made everything, decided, chose to live there. If you wanted to meet God, that's where you went. It was the centre of the whole world. And so instinctively for every Jew, it was the place God would protect no matter what, no matter what happened in the world. God would look after it. Jesus' response then must have been an absolute shock. He says to the disciple, "Do you see all these great buildings, the temple and everything in it? Not one stone will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. It will be utterly destroyed." That must have been a bizarre thing. It would be like walking past Winthrop Hall and, you know, saying to the student next to you as you walk past, "You know what? Soon that building is going to get demolished." Like, what's that about? Why would you say it? What are you trying to achieve by saying it? But it shouldn't have shocked the disciples, because if you've been here for the last few weeks, you'll know that Jesus has been talking about the destruction of the temple already. Back in chapter 11, he came in and inspected the temple, came back the next day and tried to clear the court of the Gentiles of all its trading. He'd cursed the fig tree, a parable, an enacted parable of the judgment of God coming on the temple. In chapter 12, he tells the parable about the vineyard and the tenants who won't honour the messengers sent from the owner. Not even the son, they'll kill him. What will the owner do? He will kill the tenants. The destruction of the temple should have started to make sense already. It's not just an act in history, it's God's judgment on the people of Israel for their ignoring of him, for their rebellion, for their killing of their own Messiah. Four of the disciples, when they get a chance, want to ask Jesus a bit more about it. So sitting on the Mount of Olives, overlooking Jerusalem and the temple, they ask him these questions. Verse 4, "Tell us, when will these things happen? What will be the sign they're about to be fulfilled?" Now, it's important to get these questions right. They ask two questions. When will the temple buildings be destroyed? "Jesus, you said they're going to be destroyed. When? And what will be the sign that that's about to happen?" But implied in those questions is another question which is clearly on Jesus' mind and probably on the disciples' mind as well. Because if the temple's going to be destroyed, what does that mean for the rest of the world? In their mind, it means the rest of the world will come under judgment as well. Maybe not at the same time, but if the temple comes under the judgment of God, then so will everything and everyone in the world. The destruction of the temple is not just another event in the march of time to be left in the annals of history. It's God's action. It heralds the judgment of the whole world. And so the implied question is, when will the end of the world be? When will the day of the Lord be? Will there be a sign for that? Well, as we read through chapter 13, my guess is if you have read it for yourself, you found it a slightly confusing chapter. Because it's not quite clear when Jesus is answering which question. So let's try and work it out, and at least I'll try and give you how I understand it. There are other commentators who will understand it slightly differently. I just want to warn you of that. But let me try and make some sense of it as best I can. The key to understanding, I think, what Jesus says in verses 5 to the end of the chapter is working out which question he is answering at which point in the discourse. Because it's not always clear. For example, have a look at verse 30. Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, this generation," that is the people listening to him at that time, "will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." Now, if that was true, and Jesus said that in somewhere around 33 AD, it means that all these things have to happen by about 75 AD, 80 AD. And yet it seems like some of them haven't happened. Jesus hasn't returned yet, has he? So what is the when? What are all these things in that verse? Is it everything or is it just some things? That's probably the most difficult verse in the passage. But let's start back at verse 5, the beginning of Jesus' answer. He begins by saying, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name claiming I am he and deceive many. When you hear of wars and rumours of wars, don't be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains." That is, Jesus' first answer is, when you hear of wars and rumours of wars, when you see earthquakes and famines, don't get alarmed. They are not the signs of the end. It's not the end yet because you see those things. His first answer is a negative one. You might be alarmed. You might think those things are the signs of the end, that there are more earthquakes happening. That must mean that Jesus is about to return. No, don't get alarmed. Just relax. Just settle down. Those things are not the signs of the end. They're not the things that are meant to get you going. Don't be deceived by them. In a climate of apocalyptic fervour that doomsday merchants love, you will be deceived if you get carried along with that. The religious nutters who think they've got their key, I can tell when the end of the world is, when this happens, it will come next. Don't be deceived. Don't follow them. They've got it wrong. And it's true. Earthquakes happen. Here's a graph of worldwide earthquakes in the first decade of this century. Are they increasing? No, it doesn't seem so. Sometimes the death count is higher, like it was with the tsunami in 2004, but the number of earthquakes seems to be reasonably stable. And so Jesus says, don't be alarmed by that. But he also says, be on your guard, verse 9, be alert. You'll be handed over to local councils and flogged in synagogues. Synagogues were the Jewish gatherings. They're going to have opposition from the Jews. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings. That's beyond the Jews. That's the Gentile world as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Whenever you're arrested and brought to trial, don't worry beforehand, because the Spirit will help you what to say. Brother will betray brother to death. Father his child. Children will rebel against their parents. Everyone will hate you because of me. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. There will be opposition from everyone, even your own family. And that has been happening from the time of Jesus until today. But God's agenda is clear. The gospel is to be preached to all nations. 2,000 years before Jesus is speaking, God made a promise to Abraham that through him he would bless all the nations of the world. The end of the world cannot come till all nations have received the blessing of the gospel of Jesus. And so Jesus says the end can't come until they've heard it. And what is the need for Christians? The need is to persevere, to stand firm to the end. Not thrown by opposition to give up our faith. Not carried away calculating dates, getting all hyped up, but just persevering. So Jesus' first answer to the question, when and what are the signs, is these aren't the signs. When you see these things happen, don't get alarmed. Don't think that that's the end. No, they'll be happening all the time through the period between now and the end, says Jesus. But in verse 14, Jesus changes. And he starts to answer the when question by the sign. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, when you see a sign standing where it doesn't belong, let the reader understand. That is, us as we read Mark's gospel, stop and think. Understand what he's saying. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one in the housetop go down or enter the house or take anything. This is a time to just get out. Don't waste time. Don't even go back to your house and collect your belongings. It's like your house is burning. Get out of there as quick as you can. How dreadful it'll be, verse 17, in those days for pregnant women. Pray it won't take place in winter, because in winter it's much harder to get out there and you could freeze to death. Of course, those days will be days of distress unequaled from the beginning when God created the world until now, never to be equaled again. He says there will be a sign that the temple is about to be destroyed. The sign is the abomination of desolation, which is a cryptic little phrase that I suspect many of us don't know what to do with. It occurs in Daniel. Three times in Daniel. Here's one of them. In Daniel chapter 11, Daniel says, or he's told, his armed forces, that is the armed forces of the king from the north, if you know anything about Daniel 11, will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they'll set up the abomination that causes desolation. It's an abomination, that is, it's something abominable, just absolutely disgusting, and it causes desolation, that is, it desecrates something that is holy. Now, the initial fulfillment of Daniel chapter 11 and what is prophesied there occurred in 167 BC, about 200 years before Jesus is speaking. The king of the Seleucids, one of the Greek kings from the north, called Antiochus Epiphanes, took over Jerusalem, and he went into the temple that Zerubbabel had built, the temple to the Lord God Almighty, and he erected an altar to Zeus, the Greek god, over the top of the altar for the burnt offerings. And you know what he sacrificed on it? A pig. If you know what Jews think of pigs, you can understand how the Jews might have felt when their temple has a pig offered to Zeus in the place of their sacrifices. That is a desolation of abomination. That is an abominable desecration of the most holy place in the universe. And for the Jews, it precipitated what became known as the Maccabean Revolt, where they invented guerrilla warfare against Antiochus and his successors. But now Jesus, 200 years later, predicts another act like that. That sort of thing will happen again. And when you see it, flee from Judea, flee from Jerusalem, even the countryside around, get out of there. Notice that's very geographically specific, isn't it? It's about Jerusalem and Judea. It's not about Perth and Australia. Go into the mountain areas. Don't muck about. Just get out, because it will herald a time of unequal distress. The horror in Jerusalem will be unparalleled. If you're caught in it, it will be the worst thing you can imagine. But notice Jesus implies that that is not the end. In verse 19, he says that distress won't be equal even after it. World history will go on after this distress, but this will be a climax, a heightened distress that will never be equaled again. But what's it referring to? When did that happen? Some suggest that this is the period of some great tribulation just before Christ returns, but that doesn't seem to work, because it's connected to the temple buildings that Jesus has in front of him on that day in 33 AD. And what happened to that temple? Well, if you don't know the history, let me tell you a little bit about it. That temple, which wasn't yet complete when Jesus was speaking, finally completed a few years later, was destroyed soon after in 70 AD. The Roman soldiers tore it stone from stone, completely decimated it, so that not one stone was left upon another, except some of the foundations. Now, the way that happened was, in 4 years before that, in 66 AD, the Jews revolted against Roman rule. They'd been sort of rumouring it, lots of things had been boiling for a while, but finally in 66 AD, they came out in open rebellion against Rome, fueled by the nationalism, but also extravagant prophecies of success from some of their own. The Romans responded as they normally did. They sent in the troops under Vespasian, which quickly put down all the rural areas around Judea, and many of the people fled into Jerusalem. And surprisingly, they got a respite. Jerusalem was spared, mainly because Vespasian was called back to Rome. There was a bit of civil war in the Roman Empire. He wanted to be Caesar, and he eventually became Caesar. Having become Caesar in early 70 AD, he sent Titus, one of his generals, who besieged Jerusalem in a terrible siege. The suffering is described by a Jewish historian, Josephus. He said the hunger in Jerusalem got so bad that people even stewed pieces of leather to try and make soup that they could drink and get a little bit of sustenance. He records mothers cooking their own babies to eat them, pregnant women cutting their bellies open to get the babies out to eat them. Barbaric behaviour fuelled by extreme starvation. When Jerusalem finally fell, the Roman soldiers tore the place apart. Josephus estimates that more than 1.1 million people died in the siege and the overrunning of Jerusalem. That is what Jesus is talking about. But what is the abomination of desolation? Because it must be early enough before the siege to warn people and let people get out. Well, we don't know enough of the history, but it probably refers to the time in 68 AD, that is 2 years before the siege finally took over Jerusalem, when some of the zealots, some of the really keen Jews, the politically motivated Jews, took over the whole temple themselves. They kicked out the priesthood who was supposed to be there, appointed by God, appointed their own priesthood, instituted their own sacrifices. Interestingly, there's a record from Eusebius who records Christians in Jerusalem at that time fleeing Jerusalem to Pella before the siege fell on Jerusalem and all those inside were locked in to their doom. It seemed like the zealots wanted to force God's hand to send his Messiah. But Jesus said, when you hear people saying, I'm the Messiah, don't believe them. That is just deception. That is what happened in between 66 and 70 AD perfectly fits the words of Jesus. What he said happened. That temple was destroyed. And there was an abomination, that was the sign, telling people when it would happen. But in verse 24, there's a change. There's all that, but verse 24, but in those days following that distress, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Something will happen that's so universal, apocalyptic, everything will be changed, nothing will remain the same. At that time, verse 26, people will see the Son of Man come in the clouds with great power and glory. He'll send his angels to gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heaven. The coming of the Son of Man, the usual interpretation of this is that this doesn't refer to the destruction of Jerusalem, but to the end, the return of Christ to earth. There is another suggestion as to what it might mean. That is, the Son of Man coming, which is an echo of Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. In Daniel 7, the Son of Man comes not to the earth, but to heaven, to the Ancient of Days. And maybe this describes Jesus' ascension and his sending out of his angels, his messengers with the gospel to the ends of the world. But I actually think the usual interpretation is right. Verse 26, Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, sounds very much like chapter 8. The last verse, chapter 8, verse 38, where Jesus says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. As I think verses 24 to 27 is about the last day, the end of the world, the day of the Lord, when Jesus will come, not incognito like this time, the first time, but as he really is, powerful and glorious. But in verse 28, Jesus seems to return to the question of when. When will the temple buildings be destroyed? He says, now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender, as leaves come out, you know the summer is near. Fig trees were the only deciduous tree that normally grew in the Middle East. That is, it loses its leaves in winters and gets new leaves in spring going into summer. And Jesus says, well, you know, when you see that the tree's putting out their leaves, what do? Well, you start to dust off your bathers, you get out your T-shirts, you get ready for summer, don't you? Well, he says, when you see these things happening, when you see the abomination of desolation, you know that it's near. Truly, I tell you, verse 30, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth might pass away, but my words, my predictions about what will happen, will stand. And they did. That generation saw the destruction of the temple. They saw the persecutions which started less than a year after Jesus' own death, where the apostles were hauled before the Sanhedrin. And a few years later, Paul is hauled before Felix and Festus, kings, Agrippa. With the abomination that causes desolation happened in 68 AD, and the temple was destroyed only 37 years after Jesus predicted it, while many people who'd heard Jesus were still around to see it, to take the warning. But then in verse 32, he moves focus again. But about that day or that hour, no one knows. Now, he hasn't mentioned a day so far. This is something new about that day or hour. No one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. So be on your guard. You don't know when that time will come. It's like a man going away. He leaves his house and his servants, puts his servants in charge, each with their assigned task, tells the one at the door, therefore keep watch, because you don't know when the owner of the house will come back whether evening, morning, midnight, dawn. If he comes suddenly, don't let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone. Watch. I think that is about the end, about the return of Jesus. The owner goes away. He'll return after an absence. And no one knows, not even Jesus knows when that will be, only the Father. There'll be no sign to tell you it's about to happen. No great thing in the heavens to say it's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know when. The Jehovah's Witnesses said it was going to happen in 1914. They were wrong. Nostradamus, according to some readings, said it was going to happen in 2012. They were wrong. There was a Korean church that very famously said it was going to happen in 1992. And I still remember the crowds that gathered around the church in Korea and their branch in Sydney waiting for it to happen. The media were there. It was a circus. It didn't happen. I'm glad to say the pastor of that church came out afterwards publicly and apologised for deceiving people, as he should. People claimed the Mayan calendar said that the world would end on the 21st of December 2012. They were wrong. In fact, what Jesus implies here is that everyone who tells you when it's going to happen is wrong by definition, because only the Father knows. So what do you do? Well, Jesus says, keep watch, be alert, be on your guard. Verse 37, what I say to you, I say to everyone, watch. I think this is the sort of timeline Jesus is talking about. Around 30, 33 AD, Jesus makes these predictions about the temple being destroyed. In 70 AD, the temple is destroyed, just as Jesus said, within a generation. Then he says, you don't know how long it's going to be between that and the end. The coming of the Son of Man will happen, but it'll happen when you don't expect it. Jesus makes some very clear predictions here. Very different to the Nostradamus sort of predictions, which are so vague and ambiguous you can interpret it any way you like. And it's not just crystal ball gazing. When Jesus makes a prediction, he's talking about what he himself will bring about. And you know what? It happened exactly as Jesus said. He said the temple would be desecrated. There'd be extreme distress for the people in Jerusalem, and then the temple buildings would be utterly destroyed within a generation. And it happened exactly as Jesus said. He also said the world would be a place of wars and earthquakes and famines. Well, that's pretty easy to predict. It's always been like that. It still is like that today. He said that Christians would be hated and persecuted. He said the gospel would be preached to all nations. He was right. Will the world come to an end? Will Jesus' words that day and that hour, when the final judgment will descend on planet Earth, was he right in that as well? Well, if Jesus was right on the first thing, then you can trust him on the next thing, can't you? If he said the temple would be destroyed, and it is, and he says he will return one day, the Son of Man coming with power and glory, then that will happen too, won't it? You could be excused for being sceptical. 2,000 years, nothing's happened. Each day the sun comes up. Each day is another day in the history of the world, and it feels like it'll just keep going and going and going. And you might think, well, 2,000 years, nothing has happened yet. No, that's not true. It's not that nothing has happened. In 70 AD, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. The judgment of God came on that, his central place in this world. And if that has happened, then the other must happen. If that has happened, you can trust Jesus. If that has happened, then Jesus' determination to bring the judgment of God on the evil of this world is already set in motion. The end will certainly come. So what are we to do? Well, what Jesus says is, be alert, but not alarmed. Be alert, but not alarmed. The Australian government have used it. They got it from Jesus. It's in this chapter. Be alert, but don't be alarmed. Alert means ready at all times. You remember that experience you had at school when the teacher left the classroom for a little while and they left you something to do. And I'm sure you remember the choice you had at that point. Okay, you had the choice to pretend that the teacher wasn't going to come back. Or at least for a little while. And so you could just slack off, you could muck around, you could get away with it because the teacher wasn't in the room. All you had to do was sort of keep an eye out for the signs that the teacher was coming back, the sound of the footprints outside the door or looking out the window. But you always ran the risk that you'd get caught out. Or you could say, well, whether the teacher's here or not, I don't know when they're going to come back, I'll just get on with the work. Well, that's the choice that Jesus talks about. Now, you get on with the work, that is, you stay alert, you do the task that's given to you. It doesn't matter when the teacher comes back. You'll be ready, won't you? You muck up, though, and Jesus says there won't be a sign. Whatever had to happen before I return, it happened in 70 AD. It could be any time. You don't know when. So don't be like the kids that just muck up, hoping they'll see the sign and can sort of fix themselves up before the teacher walks up back into the room. And don't be alarmed. Don't go looking for signs. Earthquakes. Oh, another earthquake. Maybe it's tomorrow that Jesus will return, and getting into some sort of panic. Martin Luther, one of my heroes, was once asked, if you knew that Jesus was coming back tomorrow, how would you spend the next day? Good question, isn't it? If you knew that Jesus was coming back tomorrow, how would you spend the rest of the day? Luther's answer was, I'd just do exactly what I planned to do anyway. And I think that's the right answer, isn't it? He was ready. He was alert, but not alarmed. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, please forgive us for being sceptical of your words, of your promise to return one day. Please help us to take seriously that your words have come true. Your words have stood, even if heaven and earth don't stand. Help us to trust your words that you will return, and help us to be alert and ready. Amen.